It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Navy Week is underway in Milwaukee. This is an outreach program with events designed to allow people to learn about this branch of the military in a city that doesn't have a large Navy presence. Call in with a question or comment about the U.S. Navy, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Matthew Sass is commanding officer for Navy Talent Acquisition Group Great Lakes and a native of Fond du Lac. Commander Officer Sass, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me this morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. So more than 75 Navy sailors in Milwaukee for Navy Week. This is the city's fourth time hosting the program. How does it feel to you to be back in Wisconsin to showcase the Navy?
This is one of those things that I'm really proud of, because I'm proud of both being from Wisconsin, doing everything that Wisconsin has, and then I'm proud of my service in the Navy and to be able to mix business and pleasure, so to speak, church and state, however you want to put it. This one's okay, and I really like it. I'm really proud that I get to be here to show off both, because not everybody that's here is from Wisconsin, the sailors at least. So getting to show them all the things that Milwaukee has to offer, I'm really proud of being able to do that.
You've been able to point out a few things as a native Wisconsinite to your fellow sailors.
One or two, yeah. When they ask, hey, where should we go to eat tonight, or what should we go see? You know, I have some ideas.
Well, take us a little bit into your path in the Navy. What's your experience been like serving?
You hear this a lot, and it sounds cliche, but if I could do it all over again, I'd do it all, to include the mistakes, the successes. I mean, the successes are always fun, but we learn more from our mistakes. I got commissioned out of the ROTC program from the University of Wisconsin, which means that the Navy paid me to go to a Big Ten university, which was where my heart always was. I was a Badger since I was a little kid. And then go to flight school, go to my squadrons, start flying the airplanes, fly the missions, serve on ships. I have done a wide breadth of things in the Navy, and I think every single one of them is unique and fun. And it's been a blast. It's been so much fun the whole time.
It's taken you across the world a number of times. And I'm just wondering then, what do you see as the Navy's role in national security?
So we are the power projection. We can get anywhere that's got water, and the oceans tend to bound everything. And that's where we live. That's where we work on a daily basis. I was always drawn to the water, so it kind of made sense for the Navy. Even though I understand Wisconsin doesn't have the really, really big bodies of water next to it, but there's one or two lakes in the state, I've been told.
Right.
I've been to most of them. So I just always love that. I'm Fond du Lac being on Lake Winnebago. I love being on the lake there. So I always wanted to be by water. So Navy made sense. And then, you know, I got to live in Japan. I got to live in Germany, East Coast, West Coast. I've been to all the continents except Antarctica. And I'm really hoping to do that one, because the Navy does do missions down there. But everywhere that the water touches, which is everything, is where the Navy's domain lies. And that's, you know, on the water, above the water, and under the water. That's the maritime domain. That's where we operate. And that's where we keep the sea lines of communication open. We make sure there's freedom of navigation. We make sure that countries that don't believe the same things that we do aren't pushing around the countries that do. And not all countries are built the same. So we try and be there for our allies. And we don't try. We are there for our allies to make sure nobody else is pushing them around.
In that maritime domain, as you call it, how would you characterize America's sea power and our maritime coalitions?
The best, period. We have what are called near peer adversaries, and we all know who they are, and it's not a secret. You know, China is developing very quickly. Russia has always been there. They kind of fall off and come back and fall off and come back, but they're called near peers because, and I'm not trying to brag on this, but I don't think they could go toe to toe with us necessarily, and they're also not you know, these aren't foolish countries. They know that there's to do something like that comes at great cost, both in dollars and lives. And nobody really wants that. We certainly don't want that. But you have to still have that trump card, so to speak. You know, you have to have those aircraft carriers. You have to have those submarines to say, hey, don't push us. We're here. We don't want to use this. And for example, I have never fired a weapon in anger in my career, and I've done an awful lot of stuff. So we don't want to shoot first, ask questions later. But it's important to know that the other guy knows that, hey, don't push us.
Commanding Officer Matthew Sass with us, representing the Navy Talent Acquisition Group Great Lakes, as we talk about Navy Week in Milwaukee and what the Navy missions mean. You can join in with your questions and your comments at 800-642-1234. Throughout the week, Navy sailors are participating in community service. Why is community engagement a priority for the Navy?
It's incredibly important. These are our communities. We live here too. Being from here, I know what it's like to grow up here. And just like any corporation in the private sector, they support their communities. They fund things. You know, there's sports teams and contests and competitions that are always, you always see those sponsors. Well, we live in these communities. These are our friends. Excuse me, our friends and family. So why wouldn't we support them? That's just what you do, especially in Wisconsin. Everybody supports everybody, so it's crucial for us to be there. And it doesn't hurt to, you know, throw on the uniform every now and then and show people, hey, you know, the Navy is a thing. I know you're not going to see an aircraft carrier or a submarine parked off the piers in Milwaukee, but we are a thing. We're here. We just happen to be over by the coast more. So it's beneficial and. We love our communities. We love our families. We love our friends. So to show support to them, that's just the right thing to do.
I think we have this perception maybe that the Navy is always out at sea or not entirely connected to a community because there is so much time spent on bodies of water or on deployments and missions elsewhere. But you're saying that it is very much connected to local communities.
Yeah, I absolutely am saying that. We go out to sea. Yes, we deploy and we take our ships, our airplanes, our submarines, and go out. But we still come back, and our families stay here. They don't go with us. That would be pretty cool, a la Star Trek or something like that. But they don't live on the ships with us when we go out. We still come back, and we know what we're fighting for, and we know what we're doing out there. And that's, you know, to protect the well-being of America and our interests and our way of life. So those communities back home, you got to have something to come back to. If you don't have anything to come back to, you're kind of lost at sea, and nobody wants to be lost at sea. So there's always got to be something to come home to. And these communities, these places we're from and where we say we're from, they matter very, very deeply to us because that's kind of our moral compass. And that's what's driving us to do the work that we do.
Navy Commander Matthew Sass hails from Fond du Lac, based at Navy Recruiting Command Great Lakes, Illinois, our guide to Navy Week events underway in Milwaukee. You can be part of the conversation. Call with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee is host to Navy Week, one of 13 cities nationwide. Sailors put on demonstrations. They do outreach to convey opportunities for prospective recruits. And you can join the conversation about this branch of military service. Call with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Commanding Officer Matthew Sass is here. So do you see connections to Navy Week and your recruits? Does the Navy Week program yield recruits to this branch of the military?
I am sure they do at some point, but that's not necessarily the point of this week, because part of our mission is Navy awareness. The recruiting aspect, you have to be out, just as we were talking before, you have to be in your communities, you have to have a trust with the Navy. Navy Week is not a recruiting week. I want to stress that. This is about showcasing the Navy and engaging in our communities, and then there are residual effects from that that will happen. So that's where the recruiting piece comes in, to show, the next generation of leaders that the Navy is that option for you. But I want to be very clear, we're not actively recruiting this week. That's what my command does from Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I've got recruiters all through there, but this week is not actively, overtly recruiting. It's just awareness and community engagement.
So Navy Week aside, recruitment, though, the Navy Times, the military news organization, says the Navy is looking to add more than 5,000 sailors in the next fiscal year. And this is despite difficulties that all military branches are facing with recruitment and retention of service members. Why do you think recruitment is a challenge?
I think as we all saw in 2020, the world changed, and that really set us back. The best comparison I can make to it is something that my mother's side of the family will understand very well, is farming. You have to plant seeds to get crops. And over the last 3 years, we haven't been able to plant seeds. When the world shut down, we weren't able to go into schools to talk to, those juniors and seniors that are make up our primary demographic. And I respected and agreed with that decision, because at the end of the day, sending my recruiters into that school, we were the threat to spread COVID, because we're interacting with a lot of people. So I understood why they didn't want us to come in. But if you don't go in and they don't see you, you're not able to plant any seeds. And it's usually a 4-year, they see you as a freshman, they see you as a sophomore, they see you as a junior, they see you as a senior, so that you're a steady state in the school, but they didn't see us. So what we were trying to do is harvest crops on whatever residuals were left in the soil. And no farmer is going to be able to do that very well. There's just not going to be much. So that was the genesis of our pandemic in the recruiting world, so to speak, and it mirrored up with real life. So that set us back, but I mean, we're back in there now. We're working. We're a little undermanned in my command, just on the Navy side. I don't have as many recruiters as I'm supposed to have, but what I've got, they are fantastic. They are some of the best sailors in the country, and the statistics for all 26 NTAGs across the country show that. They're doing really well.
We talked with a recruiter for the Wisconsin National Guard earlier this year about their recruitment challenges, and they're experiencing historic lows in enrollment. And here is Lieutenant Colonel Shannon Hellenbrand.
Although we're located in 70 communities across the state of Wisconsin, we have really been less visible and participatory in our communities over the past several years. Many of our neighbors just don't know us anymore.
Many of our neighbors just don't know us anymore. Is the Navy visible in Wisconsin?
We are not typically as visible in Wisconsin, because you can't physically see the big, cool stuff that we've got. And I agree with the Lieutenant Colonel's sentiment that, you have to be seen. And if you're not seen, you're kind of forgotten about, and we weren't able to be seen for a while. I think the National Guard and the Marines specifically do really well in the state of Wisconsin. They've got a really strong presence because they have the equipment. There's Fort McCoy up north by Toma there that, hey, they can bring their Humvees. They can show a tank off to people. They can show off that really cool equipment they've got. The only thing that I can do for the Navy is bring in our airplanes, and then people confuse us for the Air Force when we do that. So I do have some unique challenges that the other services might not have, but I'm not going to use that, and I don't think the Lieutenant Colonel is. We're not using that as an excuse. We just know that we have to do the work. We have to get into our communities. We have to be visible, and we're starting to get back there, and we're starting to do that.
you mentioned being a bit short of recruiters. Again, Navy Times reporting more than 3,900 recruiters are working 6 days a week for the foreseeable future. Are work hours perhaps deterring recruits from joining the Navy?
I don't think so. And the six day work policy did not actually end up happening. That was that was put out. It was floated as an idea. The Navy was like, well, we need to go to general quarters on this, which is, you know, our emergency situation on a ship to save a ship, put out a fire. And that one size fits all of having everybody work 6 days a week, that probably wasn't going to be the best answer. And I think our leadership saw that. We have plans in place where sailors do work Saturdays. Perfect example being, there's a Blue Angel show this weekend. They're flying Saturday and Sunday, and we're going to be there.
Nice segue.
But we do work weekends, and it's not just the Blue Angel show. We will do events. We do, you know, the summertime is, this is, Wisconsin summers are next to none. They're amazing. All the fairs, the festivals, and we go out and do those things, and they happen on the weekends. So we work Saturdays, but I would argue this is the stuff that we work the rest of the year to get to have the fun with everybody. We get to go out there and party with our neighbors and our friends. We just might have our uniform on when we do it.
Commanding Officer Matthew Sass with us talking about Navy Week in Milwaukee, represents the Navy Talent Acquisition Group Great Lakes. You can join in with your question at 800-642-1234. Mark in Waukesha is here. Mark, hi, what's your question?
Hi, I was able to serve in the Navy too. I bought a submarine back in the 70s, and it was a great experience. I wanted to ask him a few years back, maybe even less than that, the Navy went through a rough patch where ships were going aground. They blamed a lot of it on fatigue and overwork of the sailors. I wonder if he would comment on that.
Commander.
I'd be happy to, Mark. Thanks for the question. And that's, we're not, the Navy is not trying to hide what happened there. That would be foolish. We found some very serious problems in the way our surface community was conducting business, and they are the best, and we are the best Navy not because of our ships, not because of our submarines or our airplanes. We are the best Navy, as I said before, because of our people, and we weren't quite doing right for our people. So the surface community on those ships, the USS John McCain and the Fitzgerald, you know, they were the test cases that said we need to do business different. So they have kind of gone to what we've had in aviation for a long time of mandatory crew rest periods. Before you go fly, you have to have so much sleep. The surface community and the sub communities are adopting, and it is in full work, and it's been in work a couple of years to sync up circadian sleep patterns, to make sure people are rested, because we're not getting the best out of the best by not letting them recharge properly. So the Navy is actively doing that. We're working on it now. I was just in Norfolk last week, and I toured a Virginia class submarine, the New Mexico. I toured a destroyer, the USS Porter, and they all said the same thing, that they have shifted to circadian rhythm style crew rest periods. And there's another important piece there, Mark, that I want to point out that comes back to the Wisconsin ties. The current commanding officer for the USS John S. McCain is a Wisconsin native. He's a Milwaukee native, and I graduated and commissioned with him at the University of Wisconsin, Commander Joe Gunta. So there's Wisconsin's best out there leading the charge, making sure that those our number one asset, which is our sailors, are taken care of. I hope that answered your question.
Mark, thank you for the call. We have less than a minute left, but when you consider Milwaukee one of just 13 cities chosen for Navy Week program, Navy Week events, why was Milwaukee chosen for this program?
We asked because we saw an incredible opportunity. Milwaukee brings a lot of diversity. It brings a lot of character. What we call uppers, you know, people that have really high AFQT scores, which are kind of the like ASVAB and those military testing scores. Milwaukee's got that. Milwaukee's got everything that the Navy would want in a potential recruit to come here. So it made sense. And we hadn't been here in a few years. So we wanted to come to where the right place are. And when we thought Milwaukee was was the right place. And I stand by that decision. I'm glad they did it. I'm glad the Navy saw the potential there. And I think it's a great opportunity to showcase both the Navy and the city.
Commanding Officer Matthew Sass, thank you for joining us. Enjoy your time in Wisconsin.
Thank you so much for having me, Ms. Archer Kent.
I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. An infusion of grant funding will lift up practices in farming with trees or agroforestry. And the goal is to help create resilient, productive tree crops here in Wisconsin. Call in with your question or comments on tree breeding. The number to join in, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Scott Brainerd is a tree crop breeder at the Savannah Institute. That's a nonprofit based in Wisconsin and Illinois, supporting the growth of agroforestry in the Midwest. Scott, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. The Savannah Institute says its new $12.7 million in grant funding aims to expand tree crop production. And using words like climate resilient and market viable for these crops, what are your top priorities to support with these crops?
Yeah, I think what this funding is really oriented towards is making these crops viable for farmers. So the tree and shrub species that we have selected to be the main sort of beneficiaries of this money already are sort of perfectly designed to have positive ecological outcomes. So they, just as perennial species, sequester carbon. They have a perennial root system that reduces pollutant runoff into the Mississippi watershed. So these crops are just kind of perfectly designed for helping address some of the climate crises that we're facing. And our key focus with this money is to take these crops that have that kind of inherent potential to them and make them, like you said, market viable. So we're focused on quality traits that will make these nuts and fruits more appealing to consumers in a variety of different markets, but also machine harvestability. So, and other traits related to the efficiency with which farmers can grow and harvest these crops. And then finally, just, their overall performance, their yield, and how ultimately profitable these can be for farmers.
Can you name drop here on the types of trees you're working with to optimize?
Sure. Yeah. So we've selected as a just initial portfolio of crops, seven species that we're going to be working on. And that includes chestnuts and hazelnuts, which are currently consumed as a sort of specialty nut crops. Two berry crops that are grown as shrubs, American elderberry and black currant. And then a few dual-purpose crops that can be grown in what are called silvopasture systems, where you plant these in pastures where you might be grazing livestock. And that includes black locust, American persimmon, and mulberry. So those are the seven that we've picked so far.
Yes. And can you step back for just a moment here and explain, give us a bit of working knowledge about what happens in tree breeding? I'm just wondering how you are able to manipulate the tree's, you know, maybe its genetic code and in order to help improve for efforts for climate change. How do you do this work?
Sure. Yeah. Well, that's a fascinating topic. I mean, really what we are proposing and what we have started work on with these seven crops is not substantially different from the kinds of plant breeding that farmers and agricultural scientists have been doing kind of since the dawn of agriculture. So this is a continuation of the sort of techniques and methods that were used to domesticate species and make them into viable crops and then improve them as challenges and new markets developed. So our basic method and that we are beginning to develop for these seven crops is to kind of the first step and the key initial sort of material that you need to do plant breeding is genetic diversity. Mm-hmm. So we are building and planting at our Spring Green campus about an hour west of Madison, very diverse populations of all seven of these species. And those come from a variety of places. They come from farmers who are growing these crops already. They come from germplasm repositories. So these are collections of plant material held by universities, botanical gardens. The USDA maintains these sort of repositories for these crops around the country. And in addition, wild collection. A lot of these crops are not that far removed from their wild ancestors. And so we're kind of trying to draw on all of that diversity. We are planting it at our Spring Green campus west of Madison. And once those crops are established and begin to express themselves, we can begin selection. And that's kind of the bedrock of plant breeding is getting that diversity and then selecting from it to both identify new plants that might do well on farms and test those at a broader scale, as well as identify the parents that we'll then use in making controlled crosses to kind of create the next generation. And that is the cycle in a nutshell.
Thank you so much for that insight and walking us through. It sounds like your site is like the polar opposite of monoculture, where, you know, it sounds like you're really trying to pull in a lot of tree diversity there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that we can definitely learn a lot from the success and advances that have been made in annual row crop agriculture. In some ways, you know, corn and soybeans, which is what you see when you drive around the Midwest, are testaments to the amazing success that plant breeders and agronomists have had in optimizing those systems. But you're right, we want to take some of those lessons and some of those methods and apply and try to use them to diversify farms and diversify them not just for the ecological benefits of doing so, but also diversify them for farmers who might be looking for alternative income streams or ways of making of branching out into new markets and not just growing a very, very narrow slice of genetic diversity on their farms year after year after year.
Scott Brainerd with us, tree crop breeder with the Savannah Institute, as we talk about the work to expand the Midwest production of fruits and nuts and timber crops. You can join in with your questions about tree breeding, 800-642-1234. Scott, how is climate change affecting tree crops in the Midwest?
That's a great question. So we are I mean, the Savannah Institute as a whole, as a proponent and supporter of agroforestry, which is the incorporation of these tree and shrub crops onto farms, I think all of us at the organization, one of our key motivators is seeing the positive role that these species can play in mitigating climate change. So because these tree crops have this permanent biomass, they can actually sort of flip the script on agriculture and its role in the climate crisis. So right now, agriculture is one of the leading emitters in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And agroforestry can, when practiced appropriately, be a carbon sink. So it can actually draw down levels of carbon by reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So that's the way in which I think these crops can sort of directly help on the mitigation side. But your question about how is the climate is already changing and mm-hmm. is going to continue to change. How is that affecting these tree crops? Well, you know, it definitely presents challenges as it does for all agricultural crops. I mean, the drought that the Midwest is experiencing right now, trees, especially in their first year, do need irrigation. And, you know, the warming climate brings new pests and diseases to the region. I think that there's kind of two interesting things about tree crops in particular with as the climate changes. One is that as the climate warms, as the winters become more mild, actually there's a whole host of very interesting tree crop species that then sort of become viable for this region. So in some sense, there's a greater diversity of plants that you can grow, as this climate begins to warm slightly. So that's maybe slightly on the upside. There's a different mix of species that you can grow. But in addition, I think a lot of these crops are just sort of designed to be resilient. So after the first couple of years of establishment, for instance, you really don't need to provide much in the way of irrigation to a lot of well-established tree crops. There might be a slight yield penalty, in a severe drought year, but the entire crop is not going to die, for instance. And so I think so just to think about it in the context of the kind of extremes that we're experiencing this year, that's one of the ways in which I think perennial crops can help in terms of the adaptation to climate change as well.
Scott Brainerd is a tree crop reader at the Savannah Institute. Call in along the way with a question, a comment about agroforestry concepts, tree breeding. The number to join in the discussion is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With new grant funds in the works, we explore efforts to make tree crops more resilient to climate change and how agroforestry practices could affect Wisconsin farms. Call in with a question, thoughts on tree crop breeding at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Scott Brainerd is a tree crop breeder at the Savannah Institute, supporting the growth of agroforestry in the Midwest. Scott, digging more deeply into this $12.7 million, what will it enable you to do for expanding tree crop production?
Yeah, well, this funding is, we're hoping will allow us to scale up all of our work at the Savannah Institute to help provide farmers with the tools they need to diversify their farms. So this is going to look like a number of things that are going on at the Spring Green campus west of Madison, where we're planting a lot of demo farms that sort of pilot or help demonstrate new technologies that farmers can come observe at field days, and also a whole suite of educational resources that go along with those to help train farmers in these practices. And then, of course, with regards to the tree crop breeding side, this is going to provide us with more long-term support so that we can actually make the investments now in the development of those populations that I was mentioning earlier, mm-hmm. that aren't going to necessarily bear fruit for several years. And so this funding is it's a real vote of confidence in the kind of long-term nature of these crops, which aren't annual crops. So they don't provide a return in year one. And that's why getting long-term dedicated funding, I think, is so critical, not just to the direct support to farmers, but also on the research side.
Trees take time. And, you know, looking at that longer term timeline, how would farmers in the Midwest access new varieties that will be developed by the Savannah Institute? How do you make that connection?
Yeah, well, there's a sort of straightforward technical answer, which is that together with our partner organization, Canopy Farm Management, we will be, as we develop and validate new varieties that are more productive and more profitable for farmers, we will be putting those through our nursery propagation system and making those directly available to farmers through that vehicle. But then, you know, the real kind of that, you know, that's just a sort of technical challenge, and you know, is actually probably much easier to solve than how do we get farmers aware of these crops, and how mm-hmm. do we make sure that they are successful once they actually do plant them. And I think that's where all of the additional work that Savannah Institute does around education, outreach. We run an apprenticeship program every year. We have lots of field days. We'll be having an open house on Saturday, September 23rd in Spring Green. So if anybody is interested in actually seeing these crops growing and the kinds of farming systems that they allow you to practice, those I think are really sort of key educational and outreach activities that will actually
get farmers excited.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Louise from Viroqua called in, and Louise is wondering if you could talk about black locusts and how invasive they are in areas of Wisconsin.
Sure. Yeah, that's a really great question. I'm glad that I'm glad people are paying attention when I rattled off the list of species we're working on. So black locust is native to certain parts of the United States, but in other parts, it can be a very invasive and aggressive tree that people spend a lot of time and frustration trying to control. And the major reason that it is so invasive is the absolutely prolific number of seeds that a mature black locust seed can produce every single year. And so what we are trying to do with black locust in particular, and this is unique to black locust, this is not how we're approaching actually any of the other crops we're working on, is we are trying to create seed sterile forms of black locust.
Wow.
And so our method for doing that is actually something that's been done in several timber species, and that's what black locust, you know, it's a really high value timber wood, extremely rot resistant, and has potential also just as a biomass crop, in addition to having some moderate fodder potential. So what we're doing is we're trying to create triploid black locust, and that refers to how many copies of the genome it has. Humans are diploid. We have two copies of our, you know, the maternal, the we have our genes from our mom and our dad, and we have, you know, so we are a diploid in the sort of technical parlance. We are trying to create triploid black locusts, which do not produce viable seed. And so while black locusts, while even a seed sterile black locust can produce runners, we think that in certain alley cropping situations where you have very wide buffer, you know, you've planted these trees maybe on 100-foot spacings or something within a, within a row crop system, potentially, you'll be able to manage those runners. And since there will be no viable seed set, that should really reduce its invasive potential. But that's definitely something that we are not just going to go ahead with without making sure that it works. And yeah, we're trying to be careful in that when we're dealing with crops like black locust.
We're talking about the work at the Savannah Institute with Scott Brainerd, who is a tree crop breeder. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Scott, what is your view on why a Wisconsin farmer who grows corn or soybeans should consider growing fruit or nut crops?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, the specific calculus, I think, will really depend on the situation. These tree crops can fit lots of different farms in lots of different ways. If you have a stream on your property, you might plant a tree or shrub crops as a riparian buffer to prevent runoff and erosion into that stream. If you have a really exposed property, you might want to plant these crops as windbreaks. And if you're growing, you know, huge fields of corn or soy, you might consider planting a crop like chestnuts on really wide spacing in an alley cropping situation. If you're growing pastured beef, crops like persimmon and mulberry can help offset your feed costs while still allowing you to grow really great high value pasture beneath them. So there's lots of different ways that these crops can aid in improving farm profitability and also lead to pretty substantial ecological benefits. And I think that every farm is going to be very unique, and you know, every farmer is going to have their own sort of interests, capacities, and motivations. I think if you're interested in these crops, definitely go to our website, savannahinstitute.org. There you'll find a listing of all of these events that I've been mentioning. And I think seeing these crops and talking to our technical service provider team is the best way to start figuring out what might make sense for your specific farm.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Scott Brainerd is a tree crop breeder at the Savannah Institute. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.